This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. For years, dogs have been trained to guide the visually impaired, search for missing people, and sniff for bombs and drugs. But pups are now being taught to help people who have psychiatric problems, including post-traumatic stress disorder. Today we'll meet an Iraq war vet who relies on his service dog in ways that will surprise you. But there's another part of the story. His black lab and nearly 500 other service dogs have been trained by prison inmates through a program called Puppies Behind Bars. Under the program, inmates who apply and are accepted are matched with a pup who lives with them in prison and learns dozens of commands necessary for physical or psychiatric assistance or bomb sniffing. Our guests are Gloria Gilbert Stoga, who started Puppies Behind Bars in 1997, Nora Moran, a former inmate who trained dogs and now works for the program, and Paul Bang Knudsen, a retired Marine corporal who was wounded in Iraq. Gloria Gilbert Stoga, Nora Moran, and Paul Bang Knudsen, welcome all of you to Fresh Air. Gloria, let me turn to you first. The inmate gets the puppy at 8 weeks old, is that right?
Yes.
And then just tell us a bit about kind of how long they're there, what the routine is, what kind of training they do.
We raise two kinds of dogs in prison. One are bomb-sniffing dogs, explosive detection canines, which we started after the terrorist attacks of September 11th. And the other are service dogs for wounded veterans such as Paul. If it's a bomb-sniffing dog, it stays with us for about a year. If it's a service dog, it stays with us for about a year and a half or 2 years. In both cases, even though the training is wildly different, the bonding, the love, the nurturing, the constant care and the full responsibility for a live being is the same regardless of type of training the dog's undergoing and regardless of whether it's a male or a female inmate who is the puppy raiser, as we call them.
The dogs, do they live with the inmate 24/7 in their cell?
Yes. Yes, they live in the cells with the inmates 24/7. There's a kennel that's set up in every cell. We have an extensive volunteer network of 400 volunteers who agree to take the puppies out of prison either for a couple of hours or for a weekend so that the dogs can get exposed to the real world. If the dogs only grew up in prison, they would be extremely well behaved. They would be very well loved. But they would become concerned when a bus went by or that when a kid came by in a on a skateboard or something like that. So we have an extensive volunteer network that does take the dogs out of prison. And every single weekend, we run two puppy shuttles into Manhattan where the dogs spend a weekend getting used to the urban chaos of New York.
Okay. So they get their training in prison, but they get acclimated to civilian life on the weekends.
Yes. Yep.
Now tell us about the training that the inmates actually perform. How many hours a week? How difficult is it? What do the dogs learn?
For the explosive detection canines, we teach them a couple of things. We teach them to use their noses rather than their eyes to find a hidden object. We teach them to go into a room and do a search pattern so that they're literally sniffing every single surface in the room. And we teach them to be well behaved. For the service dogs, we teach them 85 different commands, five of which we made up, and Paul actually gave us one to make up, that our soldiers and Marines have told us would be useful in their lives with our dogs. That includes everything from picking up an object, opening a door, holding the door open, getting a water bottle out of the refrigerator, turning on and off lights. The specialized commands, which Paul may well address, are specifically for wounded warriors with PTSD and or traumatic brain injury.
That sounds like dozens of commands to learn.
It's dozens of commands. To answer your question, how long are the dogs trained? They're trained throughout the day in small segments that, A, it's easier for the dog to learn, and B, it's more humane. When the inmate is – the dogs go everywhere with the inmate. So if the inmate is in a class, if the inmate is in a vocational program, if the inmate's going on a visit with his family, the dog goes with the inmate. So basic commands like sit, down, stay are reinforced throughout the day. It's not a training period per se. The specialized commands, yes, the inmates may train for 20 minutes here, 10 minutes there. It depends on how quickly the dog learns.
You know, dogs do have personalities. Can you tell Gloria when one won't work, or are there some kinds of personalities that would work better, for example, for bomb sniffing as opposed to other service?
Well, the funny thing is, Samba started out as a bomb sniffer. I mean, Paul can talk about that. And you know what? She would have made a great bomb sniffer, but she had such a wonderful, outgoing but mellow personality that when she was about, I don't remember, maybe around 5 months old, I said, look, you know, she could be a great bomb sniffer, but I think she could really work with a wounded soldier. So we switched her. She was originally raised in a men's prison, and that's when we switched her to the Bedford Hills Correctional Facility. So, yes, dogs absolutely have different personalities, and dogs have different penchant for training. And we just switched some puppies that we thought were going to be service dogs. We tried them out for a couple of months, and they didn't like the training. They just weren't focusing on the command. So we just moved them over to be bomb sniffers where it's going to, we think, better match with their personalities.
So the kind of personality that works better as a bomb sniffer is one, what, it can handle a little less complexity maybe? Or?
I actually liken it to the bomb sniffing dog is the dog who is going to be more out front, who's going to make decisions. The service dog is the dog that's going to constantly look up at the owner and the handler and say, what do you want me to do now? Do you want me to open the door? Do you want me to got my back? Do you want me to turn on that light? So the bomb sniffer is kind of more in your face, if you will, and the service dog is more, okay, tell me what's next and I'll do it.
Do you think that there is something about the life of a prison inmate that makes them particularly well suited for this kind of work? Obviously, they're available, but is there anything about their experience that you think makes this work?
I think the emotional fragility of inmates makes it work. Those of us who have dogs, know dogs, or any animal for that matter, know that dogs love unconditionally. Know that dogs have this extraordinary ability to heal. And I have heard time and time again from inmates saying that they will tell their dog things that they've never told anybody else. Their dog doesn't care what their crime was. Their dog doesn't care what their social status in life is. All their dog cares about is that this person loves me, this person takes care of me, this person feeds me, and in return, I give kisses and love 24 hours a day. So I think that the emotional fragility of inmates, yes, makes them good trainers. I also think that for the right inmate, the ability to contribute to society while incarcerated is unique. And we look for men and women who say, okay, I committed a horrendous crime. I want to do something positive, and I want to do something positive not just for myself, but much more importantly, I want to do something positive for others. That combination, I think, makes inmates extraordinary dog trainers.
You know, I hear some real emotion in your voice as you describe that. These relationships must be really powerful for you to witness and experience.
They are. And when we get started talking with Paul, you're going to hear more emotion because working with our wounded warriors is just so deeply gratifying. It is. We see transformations constantly. We see inmates who were withdrawn. I mean, there are so many parallels, and Paul may address this later. There are a lot of parallels between the wounded warriors who are prisoners in their own homes and the inmates who are prisoners in prison. But the inmates who are withdrawn, who are perhaps shell-shocked, for lack of a better word, the dog brings them out, the team, because it's a team effort to raise a dog, brings them out. People really blossom. So I see that month after month, year after year, and yes, it's something that's very gratifying to me.
I want to turn to you, Nora Moran. You're a former inmate. You're now a staff mm-hmm. member for Puppies Behind Bars. First, just tell us a little bit about what landed you in jail and how long you were there before you became connected with the program.
Well, I became incarcerated at age 17 for armed robbery. I was a really angry, lost, confused young adolescent girl, and I used that anger to lash out at innocent people. So when I became incarcerated, I needed to understand that I didn't want to be a person who created damage in the world. I wanted to be a person who was a vehicle for healing and growth. So 2 years after I became incarcerated, I joined Puppies Behind Bars and started realizing that dream of being able to be a vehicle for healing and growth.
Tell us about your first puppy.
My first puppy, his name was Mr. Bill. He was a black lab. He was actually started by another raiser who was then transferred to another facility. And after 2 months of being in the program, Gloria decided that I had worked so hard and had become so skilled that she'd give me a chance to raise a puppy. So Bill was 4 months old when I became his primary raiser, and once he learned how to walk, he was absolutely one of the easiest dogs I've trained yet. He was a great dog.
Was learning to walk an issue for Mr. Bill?
Learning to walk, yes. He did not want to leave the housing unit. He was used to being carried and kind of pampered, so asking him to leave his comfort zones was a bit of a challenge, but once he got that going, he was easy to go from there.
Huh. Didn't know he was in for the life of a working dog yet, huh? You know, having a dog with you all the time, sleeping in your cell, must have set you apart from other inmates. How do you think it changed the way you were perceived and treated by others in the prison?
Well, it definitely made me become a role model to my peers. In order to be a part of Puppies Behind Bars as an inmate, you really have to understand that it's about a lot of a sacrifice. There are a number of programs, specifically in Bedford Hills Correctional Facilities, that any inmate can choose to participate in. But to be a puppy raiser means that you have to put the puppies absolutely first and foremost in your life, and that means you can't participate in some of the other things that other inmates would participate in, like recreational activities, educational activities.
Why would having the dog prevent you from engaging in recreational and educational activities in the prison?
Because working with the dog is a 24/7 commitment, and that commitment to take care of the dog's grooming needs, exercise needs, and training needs takes over a huge portion of your day. We say that the puppy's learning something every moment it's awake. And as you know, little puppies, they're full of life and energy and want to explore. And some of them don't sleep very much. So it's a huge responsibility. And some people can't juggle both.
This is maybe a silly practical question, but, you know, if a puppy wants to start yapping and you're, you know, in a cell block full of a lot of other inmates that might not appreciate it, is that an issue?
Well, luckily the puppy program exists on units where everybody living in those units understands that certain things aren't going to happen on those units that don't exist in the rest of population. So we do set it up where people are more tolerant of that. But we also teach the puppies from 8 weeks of age on not to bark. Of course, they do on occasion, especially when they first arrive, but that doesn't last very long.
You know, if you're really with the animal 24/7 for a year or a year and a half, it must be awfully hard to say goodbye.
It is awfully hard, but it's kind of like sending them off to puppy college. We understand that the year in a couple months that we spend pouring our love and pouring our commitment into that dog is going to go off and share that same love with a veteran returning from war. And it gives that love to society before we get there. So it's an incredibly, it fills us with pride as well as a hinged in a little bit of sadness.
That was Nora Moran. She works with the program Puppies Behind Bars. Also with us, the program's founder, Gloria Gilbert Stoga, and Paul Bang Knudsen, who has a dog from the program, and he was wounded in Iraq. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the program Puppies Behind Bars, in which Prison inmates train animals to assist wounded veterans to become bomb-sniffing dogs and perform other tasks. With us are the program's founder, Gloria Gilbert Stoga. Nora Moran, she is also an administrator of the program and was an inmate who trained dogs at one point. And also with us is Paul Bang Knudsen. He is an injured veteran who has a dog now. Well, Paul Bang Knudsen, let's talk about your story. I mean, first of all, you were a corporal in the Marine Corps in Iraq, right?
That's right.
Tell us how you were injured.
We were in a special forces unit, Marine Force reconnaissance duty, and we drove into an area near Syria and engaged in got ambushed simply, and I suffered gunshot wounds and to the leg and some concussive IEDs and RPGs. So pretty much they threw the book at us. And that pretty much, changed sort of the landscape of my own life.
I'm sure.
So
yeah.
I was removed from the battlefield in expedited fashion and back to California eventually. For about a year, and now I'm, this is about 3 years later. I'm here in Seattle, Washington, and I had some problems with isolation, and starting to sort of the PTSD signature is sort of experiencing things out in the civilian population that startle you and. People term them as flashbacks or sort of re-experiencing based on stress. So that can happen in a supermarket or wherever, and it's not really a socially acceptable behavior. So what tends to happen is sort of an isolation process. And as I was becoming isolated, I was understanding that something was going wrong, and I, kind of knew that this was an issue. It, so the VA is making all kinds of efforts to mitigate this disability and return to a healthy lifestyle. That's how I found out about this program, Puppies Behind Bars.
Now, if I can just ask, do you have physical impairments in addition to the post-traumatic stress disorder?
Yes, I do. I got shot in the leg, and I lost a lot of muscle, and there's nerve damage there. So, I walk with a minor limp, I suppose. But other than that, it's pretty it's very much an invisible injury. In that I, can walk around and people don't necessarily guess what's wrong.
Well, tell us about getting Samba, your dog. Describe her for us, if you will.
Samba's a black lab, and most people that come up and ask or say, is she English? And she's a smaller variety, she's an incredibly adorable dog, and it's something that, she almost creates a crowd or people do notice this dog. She is a black-coated dog that, with a very shiny coat.
And they're in the studio with you, right?
And she is on the floor of the studio today. So she wears her... her service cape. I always wear this, or she has this service cape that identifies her as a Puppies Behind Bars service dog for veterans of the Dog Tags program. And there's a do not distract patch on there. We just got cards from the Puppies Behind Bars program. It says. That we're able to give out now, and they say I'm a veteran who fought in Iraq or Afghanistan and have post-traumatic stress or traumatic brain injury. My service dog assists me through my daily routines. Please do not pet her as it distracts her from doing her job. So, I mean, you know, it's I live in a community that's fairly knowledgeable of service dogs. So I don't have a lot of problems. It's when I, you know, go out into, I guess, tourist areas or, you know, I went to the Museum of Flight to Washington, D.C. at the Smithsonian, and it was a different story than my regular routine.
Right.
It was a bit of a spectacle because it's such a cute dog, but it's one of the things that she really is doing a job for me. Mm-hmm. So,
Paul Bang Knudsen was a corporal in the Marine Corps when he was wounded in Iraq. Gloria Gilbert Stoga founded the program Puppies Behind Bars, and Nora Moran is a former inmate who now works in the program. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. We're talking about an innovative program called Puppies Behind Bars, in which pups are sent to live in prison with an inmate who trains the dog to either sniff for bombs or assist someone with a physical or psychiatric condition, like post-traumatic stress disorder. Our guests are Gloria Gilbert Stoga, who founded the program, Nora Moran, a former inmate who trained dogs and now works with the program, and Paul Bang Knudsen, an Iraq war vet who suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder and has a service dog named Samba. Could you describe some of the difficulties that you were having and how Samba helps day to day?
Sure. Samba has been trained specifically to mitigate the my startle response. For example, any supermarket, I think about like a Costco or something, you know, maybe a larger store with big aisles, and walking around those corners is a stressor for me. And when I think everybody's run into someone like coming around, meeting at those intersections of the aisles of, you know, you're coming around the corner, a blind corner in a supermarket. And well, the normal reaction is, you know, excuse me, or you can laugh it off. The startle response for someone with PTSD who already has their hypervigilance up is something that it increases and can lead to sort of flashbacks of memories of war and being, you know, in a survival instinct, fight or flight situation. So one of the commands that Gloria was speaking of earlier is we have Samba pop the corner. And what she does is she walks slightly ahead of me and simply looks around corners and identifies whether or not there's people there to me by stopping and looking at me. And we have what's called synchrony. And Samba and I have been paired long enough that we are working together and are on the same schedule. So that's one specific task or skill trained to mitigate my disability. She also does things like standing in line. She knows to watch my back, and that is the same sort of thing. If anyone, basically, it's not like an aggressive dog in any way, but she will notify me if someone is coming to tap me on the shoulder or startle me in any other way, I guess. So she
and how does she notify you? Yeah, how does she notify you?
She performs a block and, reaches out to greet that person. So she removes herself from a sit to greet the person. And she also does a block, which would create basically a body bubble of space between the person and myself.
Gloria Gilbert Stoga, you run this program. These are really fascinating things to hear.
And I'd like to follow up on something Paul just said. We, at this point, have paired 15 veterans with our dogs, and I feel that we learn from each and every one. We learn from the mistakes we make, but we also learn from the vets what they need. And it was actually Paul who taught us Pop a Corner. It was in training, and you were going into a room, I believe, Paul, and Samba went ahead of you, and she looked to the left, and she looked to your right, and you said, oh, she just popped a corner, and we said, what? In heaven's name is that? And you said, dog looked left, dog looked right. I know it's safe to enter that room. As a result, 100% of our dogs since Samba are now taught that command. So it's really cool that the veterans help us understand what they need in their service dog.
Yeah. Let me ask you, either of you, I mean, what are some other specific ways that dogs are trained to help vets with post-traumatic stress?
Another one of our veterans whose flashbacks are physically debilitating, and he ends up oftentimes on the floor in the fetal position. His wife went shopping one day, left Alan home with the dog, came back from the supermarket, and Frankie, the dog, was standing at the front door. And Gina, the wife, thought, that's weird. Why isn't Frankie with Alan? Oh, well. Went back to the car, got more of the groceries. Frankie, the dog, was still at the front door. And at that point, Gina said, oh, my God, there's something wrong. And she went running down the hallway. And there is Alan on the floor in a fetal position, completely unresponsive. When we heard that, we said, we've got to do something if the dog and the soldier are alone and there's no human there. So since then, we've taught all of our dogs to literally dial 911 on a phone, not only on the command help, but if all of a sudden I were to stop talking or if I were to fall out of my chair, the dog would be cued and would dial 911. So that's another example of a real-life situation. Veteran gets home with one of our dogs and says, hey, I could use this in my real life because it happens to me.
How does a dog dial 911?
I'll tell you the secret. It's a large phone. Generally, it's a phone for the visually impaired, and it's a wall phone, and each of the numbers are pre-programmed 911. So every single command we teach, we break down into basics. So first, we taught the dog to go to the phone, literally with its mouth, take the receiver off, and then with its nose, press any one of those buttons, each of which will work. And one of the inmates actually rigged up that once the button's pressed, a light goes on. So both the dog, I guess probably more the humans, can see, hey, dog made enough contact. And then the dog goes right back to the soldier or the inmate who's pretending to be a soldier on the floor. And we'll repeat that if indeed help doesn't come. But that's how we taught it. Get the phone, take the receiver, push with your nose, and any one of these buttons will do it.
And are they supposed to bark once, you know, the emergency personnel come on the line?
Good question. We don't teach them that. One of the other things we've learned, and Paul, this may be different for you and I'd actually be interested, is at least in some of the small towns in which our veterans live, the local emergency and police know that there's a veteran at that house with post-traumatic stress disorder and or traumatic brain injury. So if there were a 911 call from the house, immediately the medical or law, you know, would go to the house because they're already pre-programmed that someone lives there who could need help. Paul, I don't know if that exists for you or not, that your local EMS or whomever knows that you might need help.
They have a list, I guess, but it's anytime 911 is called in our area, it's dispatched. So no one has to say anything necessarily.
Right. Big cities have computer-aided dispatch in which the address of the number pops right up for the operator. Is there another example of like that of how she helps?
The main thing is that she will my command is find the car. For example, in these supermarket situations, so evacuating a mall. So it sounds light, but it getting out of the stressful situation is a big piece, and she will lead the charge back to the car. And using her nose, she is very adept at finding my car or going back to the car even we rode in. So if I'm in a carpool or anything like that.
How long have you had Samba, Paul?
I've had Samba, I believe, somewhere in the 6 month. Is it 6 months, I think?
Yeah, February of this year.
And have you noticed any sustained difference in your mood or reaction since she's been with you?
The answer is yes. I've had a lot better time engaging a normal or happy civilian life since I've had Samba. And there's other pieces to the dog ownership that some are trained commands and some are the value of dog ownership. They have a great internal clock and setting a routine for myself with traumatic brain injury. That's an important piece. It's the working on time management. If she needs to eat at a specific time every day, and she certainly knows when that is. other events can revolve around that and do. So she also needs to get out and exercise. And the isolation piece, I think, is really one of the biggest problems of kind of going down the wrong road. Continuing to isolate yourself as a PTSD veteran is really, I guess, the sickness or the problem. And getting out, and this is something that is, Samba is a social ambassador and is able to take the focus or attention off of me or the veteran in public. And it also takes my attention off of the hypervigilance. So instead of looking at the mall as a series of sniper locations and, possible IED bags or, debris cans or, looking at the normal civilian environment as a hostile threat, I'm actually focused on the reinforcement of the training and the dog, not only with, my eyes and watching her, that she is performing these commands properly, but mentally we're synchronized in getting from point A to point B without diverging into the perceived threat.
Paul Bang Knudsen is a former Marine corporal who was wounded in Iraq. Gloria Gilbert Stoga founded the program Puppies Behind Bars, and Nora Moran works in the program. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're speaking with Gloria Gilbert Stoga, who founded the program Puppies Behind Bars, Nora Moran, a former inmate who now works with the program, and Paul Bang Knudsen, an Iraq war vet who has a service dog named Samba, who was trained in prison. Paul, do you know where Samba was trained or any of the inmates that were involved in her training?
I do. Puppies Behind Bars has a program where they the inmates do a wonderful job of documenting, and they've got notebooks, which was, awarded to me once we graduated, or they were given to me by Gloria. And it's an amazing story. It has every day, every portion of the day documented as to how Samba was acting and what she was doing and if she was in a good mood or in a bad mood. And even the folks that volunteered to take her out on the weekends write reports to the inmate trainers, and that's included in the books. And there's a few snapshots in there, and it's a wonderful story. And I have referenced that time and time again because I've learned that these inmate trainers are absolute masters and know this system and and how they, you know, it's funny, you know, if Samba used to get skitterish on the public transit on the bus because there was a, you know, an alarm that went off when it lowered, and, you know, in combination with the air brakes. And, you know, she got skittish. And it was funny because I went back to that book and with two of the inmates, and they had experienced her digging her heels in before, and simply using that advice of, you know, staying consistent and, you know, not over babying her necessarily, but it was good to reference.
Yeah, Nora Moran, I wonder if when you were incarcerated and training puppies, did you have occasion where you met, you know, people like Paul whose lives had been changed by some of the animals that you had helped to train?
Yeah, I was lucky enough to be in Puppies Behind Bars at a time where we had a number of the companions who've received our dogs have come back and thanked the group of puppy raisers who were participating in the program at that time. Out of five dogs that I've raised, four of them became working dogs. None of the people who received my dogs came back, but several of the people, when we were working with Guiding Eyes for the Blind, came back to thank our class. And even our first dog tags graduate, Bill Campbell, came back to thank our class while I was in the program. And it was just a remarkable experience to know that how many lives that we've touched based on the work and love that we've put into raising these dogs.
You know,
and not only do the soldiers' lives get touched or the companions' lives get touched, but every life that soldier comes in contact with as well.
Yeah, so. their families and loved ones as well. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Definitely.
You know, Gloria Gilbert Stoga, I mean, this is interesting because you've got, you know, inmates, although, I mean, they obviously caused harm in someone else to be where they are people who are often, you know, harmed and damaged themselves. And you have this other group of people, in the case of vets, and who are, you know, who suffered, you know, terrible injuries. And they're doing something which helps each other. Is it important for you to kind of have both sides see the emotional connection there?
Yes. I'm extraordinarily lucky that 12 years later, Puppies Behind Bars is still as relevant and rewarding to me personally as it was in 1997. As Nora just said, we've had recipients of our dogs, guide dog users, Bill Campbell, our first dog tags vet, and law enforcement agents come in and thank the puppy raisers. We had a group of our soldiers, our dog tag soldiers, come into a men's prison last fall. And I have never, ever seen the kind of immediate bond I saw between those wounded soldiers and our inmates. And I was sobbing. The men were sobbing. And sobbing in front of a woman and sobbing in front of corrections officers doesn't happen that often in a men's prison. But they just spoke the same language. They were on the same level that these dogs had helped them both get out of their emotional shells, and as Paul just said, get out of that isolation. And that is something that I'll remember forever, and so will the inmates. It was just, you couldn't have staged it.
You know, I guess you don't pay inmates to do this, but this is a fairly expensive undertaking, isn't it, Gloria?
It is. It costs us $26,000 per dog per wounded warrior. By the time Paul and Samba flew home together, Puppies Behind Bars had put that amount of money into the dog. And then, of course, you can't quantify the love.
Now, talk a little bit about where you get the animals. If I read, you get some from mostly from breeders. You get not so many from shelters. Is there a reason for that?
Yeah, we have gotten five rescue labs in the past. They were wonderful dogs. All of them, it was probably just bad luck of the draw, all of them ended up having serious medical conditions that weren't apparent when they were younger. And so not only did we put all of the time and love into the dogs, but then we were in the position of having to find homes for doggies that had, you know, for example, elbow dysplasia. So not only did it prevent us from having a dog to graduate, but it also took us away from our main mission. So we really primarily only use dogs from breeders.
Well, before I let you all go, I wanted to give you an opportunity to say anything else that you want to that we might not have covered.
I just want to say, and I hope I don't tear up, meeting Paul and meeting the other veterans has just been so deeply rewarding. Puppies Behind Bars started dog tags when I, just as a private citizen, would read the paper every day and just hear about the number of our men and women who are getting wounded. And I said, what can I do? I'm sitting here in my comfort of New York and they're in Iraq and Afghanistan. What can I do? And the answer was, I can do dogs. And that was the genesis of dog tags. And I just, every single day, I just feel so lucky that we have men and women who are fighting for our country. And I think I speak for Nora when I say that meeting Paul has really, it's broadened our horizons and it's really taught us a lot, not only about service dogs, but more importantly about the human spirit.
Well, Gloria Gilbert Stoga, thanks so much for sharing the program with us.
Thank you.
Nora Moran, thank you so much as well.
Thank you.
And Paul Bang Knutson, thanks so much for coming in and bringing Samba and telling us about your story.
Thank you very much.
Gloria Gilbert Stoga founded the program Puppies Behind Bars. Nora Moran is a former inmate who now works at the program. Paul Bang Knutson is a former corporal in the Marine Corps who was wounded in Iraq. Coming up, John Powers on the new detective novel by Thomas Pynchon. This is Fresh Air. Now in his 70s, the acclaimed writer Thomas Pynchon is best known for long, dense novels, most famously Gravity's Rainbow, which won the National Book Award in 1974. In his new book, Inherent Vice, he tries something completely different, a private eye novel in the tradition of Raymond Chandler and Walter Mosley. Our critic at large, John Power, says it's an enjoyable book by a writer whose work can be daunting.
It wasn't so long ago that detective fiction was considered a lowbrow form that was somehow beneath serious writers. The triumph of pop culture changed all that. These days, many of our most acclaimed literary figures, including Kazuo Ishiguro and John Banville, Michael Chabon and Jonathan Lethem, are writing novels that send investigators walking down those famously mean streets. The latest to do so is Thomas Pynchon, the publicity-shy 72-year-old wizard who broke onto the scene in 1963 with V, a globe-trotting epic about paranoia and patterns, history and entropy, that's one of the great first novels ever written. In the decades since, he's made himself into a cult hero with a series of dazzling, difficult books, most recently the underrated Against the Day, that have fallen to earth like the monoliths at the beginning of 2001. I know people who swear that Pynchon has saved their lives, but I know others who say he's literally unreadable. Nobody will say that about Inherent Vice, his loosey-goosey new take on the L.A. private eye yarn. The scene is Gordita Beach, 1970, and the age of Aquarius is yawning, not dawning. The detective is Larry Doc Sportello, a short, big-haired stoner who's closer to Elliot Gould's Philip Marlowe than to Humphrey Bogart's. As for the case, well, it begins with a woman, Doc's ex-flame Shasta. She turns up asking for help with her current boyfriend, a real estate mogul who's been getting threats. Still love-struck, Doc agrees and promptly plunges into the madness of L.A. Noir, with its resurrected rockers and murderous neo-Nazis, its hot-to-trot chicks, and needless to say, a friendly nemesis of a cop who, it is necessary to say, is probably the book's smartest and most complicated character. For all its shagginess, Inherent Vice does honor the rituals of the traditional detective story. Doc follows leads, goes undercover, gets conked on the noggin. There's even a fresh description of the Santa Ana winds. Their dryness causes the state seals on tequila bottles to come unstuck. And these have been a staple of Southern California fiction since Raymond Chandler's story, Red Wind. At the same time, the book brims with Pynchon's trademark silliness, from characters with names like Jason Velveeta and Sledge Poteet to elaborate riffs on pop culture. For instance, an imaginary TV movie called Godzilligan's Island, or a hilarious discussion of Charlie the Tuna's death wish. I suspect that for Pynchon, as for so many other so-called literary writers, one great appeal of detective fiction is that it's formulaic. This takes away the pressure to be brilliantly original. You just follow the rules and burrow into what excites you. That's what Pynchon does in Inherent Vice, probably the closest thing to autobiography we'll ever get from this most private of writers. He lived in Manhattan Beach during the late 1960s, And in its cockeyed way, the novel glows with his nostalgic fondness for countercultural L.A., with its surfers and druggies, its rock and roll dreamers, and beautiful losers. These include the soulful, chivalrous Doc, a terrific character who loves Lakers star Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and the brooding blacklisted actor John Garfield. I'm betting that Pynchon does too. Precisely because the book is deliberately minor, it feels like one from the heart. Of course, the limitation of detective novels is that what's most satisfying about them, the way things all tie up, can become predictable, even mechanical. This doesn't matter so much when an author invents a whole world, as in Michael Chabon's marvelous tour de force, The Yiddish Policeman's Union. But it's a real letdown in a more straightforward mystery like Banville's Christine Falls, a hauntingly dank evocation of 50s Dublin that ultimately gets bogged down in the busy work of who did what and why. The sort of bookkeeping that dedicated crime writers usually do better than literary stars. Here, Doc solves the crime, but the book ends not with reassuring closure, but with an intimation of huge sinister forces and our hero driving in heavy fog. In this, Inherent Vice offers a simplified version of Pynchon's enduring political theme. The way that the search for freedom and solidarity, be it by the Wobblies or bebop musicians or 60s longhairs, is forever being done in by those who would appropriate the whole world under the banner of greed and fear. Like a good noir detective, Pynchon roots for the underdog, but he knows that the world's inherent vice is that it belongs to the powerful.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Thomas Pynchon's new book is Inherent Vice. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org.